Good evening, everyone. Almost all of you are familiar faces, or as I was saying to Jamal, your friends are familiar faces. So we're foregoing any kind of formal introduction. My name is Naya Swami Asha. I'm visiting India from my home in California. I'm here representing the gurus that you see behind you, and specifically my personal life training has been through a direct disciple of Yogananda, an American disciple named Swami Kriyananda. I have been devoted to learning from him since the age of 22, which is now more than 40 years. Time goes by in a flash, that's all I can say. This is the fourth in the series of classes that we're having. All of these classes are based on the books called the Wisdom Series of Paramhansa Yogananda. Tonight and tomorrow night, our subject is really essentially the same subject. Tonight, we're calling it spiritual relationships. Tomorrow night, we're calling it how to love and be loved. The second is the actual title of Yogananda's book. And there's a few other books that pertain to this subject. I believe Expansive Marriage is there, Secrets of Friendship. I meant to look, but I didn't. I'll check afterwards. There's a tremendous amount to say on these subjects, and they are perhaps among the most important that we talk about, because our relationships with each other are a source of pain, fulfillment, and excuse me, there's something sharp on this microphone. Every time I say something too emphatic, it stabs me. I don't know whether it's approving or disapproving, but it's really unpleasant, whatever it is. There it is, I think. Try to see if I can stick it more on the outside. There. Well, we have a phrase, I will suffer for my art, so I will just suffer for my art here. because also our relationships with each other are one of the greatest ways that we learn who we are, what our limitations are, and discipline ourselves really to live a more spiritual life, because the incentive is so strong. So it's quite appropriate that we're devoting two of our sessions to this. For those of you who've been coming all week, I've been cheerfully telling you that we were going to have a class on the chakras and promising you that when we had the class on the chakras, I would reveal certain secrets I was withholding. I actually looked at the program and realized there is no class on the chakras, which might have been something I should have looked at much earlier. But in as much as the Saturday class is longer, and the subject is health and vitality, I can probably torque it a little to at least tell you some of what I've been withholding all this time. So in case any of you are astute enough to notice that I'm not, that's what we'll do for that. So now I've asked Duti and our little group of singers over here to sing two songs for us on the subject of relationships. The second one will be obvious. It's called Many Hands Make a Miracle. The first one is, the title of it actually is Go On Alone, which is a little bit counterintuitive for a class on relationships. And ironically, is these two songs together, Swami Kriyananda considers both of them to be the theme song of our community. And on rare occasions, somebody has actually allowed Swami to sing Go On Alone for a wedding ceremony, but very rarely, and only a couple with a very good sense of humor has allowed that to happen. This was years ago when Swami himself used to conduct the weddings. But in the course of my speaking this evening, I'll try to express why both of those seemingly contradictory songs are really the essence of success in our relating to other people. So without further ado, we'll do those two songs for you. Be careful of my microphone wire. Yeah, thank you.
Man, even though you walk alone,
Let's sit for just a moment of silent meditation, just to gather our energy into a one-pointed focus. I know some of you have had a very long day, so let us just relax into the next 1 hour and a half. And pray that God and the Gurus bring to us in this time together the specific inspirations, the answer to the most significant questions that we are asking inside. This is a subject that is extremely personal. This is not a theoretical subject for us. This is something that we live and breathe every day. So let us ask, as I say, God and Gurus, to inspire each one of us with the inspiration and the receptivity to bring us the understanding that we need to move closer to the light. Om peace. Amen. Swami Kriyananda has recently completed what is actually his 150th book. And he wrote it in 8 days, recently in the Pune community, as it happened during the time when I was visiting there. The name of the book is called Love Perfected, Life Divine. And it's a very unusual book because he actually took a novel that was written by a woman named Marie Corelli. About 100 years ago, Marie Corelli was a very popular novelist. I believe she was British. She wrote quite a few books and was quite a hit during her time. And she was unique in that she actually wrote novels with a very spiritual theme about people who loved God and wanted a pure life and had high aspirations. No one before or since has ever written books like she wrote. She was, however, a little bit flawed as an artist. She thought if something was worth saying once, it was worth saying 10 or 12 times. And if it was if a lush description was good, then a super lush description was even better. So there were way too many words in her books, is the only way I can put it. A book reviewer once described a book as having the serious flaw of there being too many pages between the front and back cover. Also, even though she had high aspiration, she reached a little beyond herself in the book she wrote. Nonetheless, her books had tremendous merit, and there was one in particular called The Life Everlasting. And it is reputed to be the only novel that Paramahansa Yogananda ever read all the way through to the end, which is a very strong recommendation for it. Swamiji has always really enjoyed the book, despite the fact, as he puts it, that Marie Corelli is a little irritating in many of her attitudes. She had a superior attitude about women toward men, and so she played that up, a lot of things like that. but her plots were tremendously imaginative. Her images were really magical. So he took the skeleton of her book, The Life Everlasting, and he wrote it again. And the combination is really extraordinary, and here is where the relevancy of it is. The theme of The Life Everlasting is soulmates. The idea that there is somehow for every person in the world a divinely destined other. And of course, it's a fascinating idea. And Paramhansa Yogananda spoke about the subject one time when he was commenting on the Bible, and there is the line that says, "What God has joined together, let no man put asunder." Now, fundamental Christianity takes that to mean that married couples should never divorce, that it's against the law of God for married couples to divorce, which of course causes tremendous chaos. I literally have a friend whose life partner died after, I think, almost 50 years of marriage. He was a practicing Catholic. He subsequently fell in love with another woman at, you know, his age at 75. And because they were both Catholics, they wanted to marry. So they actually had his first marriage annulled. How you can annul a 50-year marriage that has produced two children, I have no idea. But in order to sort of satisfy the dogmas of the church so he could marry again and still take communion, I mean, it becomes, with all due respect, ridiculous. And Yogananda, in commenting on that passage, said it has nothing to do with marriage, which is a man-made convention. To merely have a priest say you are now married in the eyes of God does not make you married in the eyes of God necessarily. And what God has joined together is requires more than just a few rituals to make it true. And oftentimes, as Swami has been in his blunt way to point out, sometimes the fact that couples don't separate is no spiritual victory. It's just a kind of endurance contest rather than a real spiritual triumph. But that's an entirely other subject. But what Yogananda was actually referring to in that one statement was the fact that, in fact, just like everything else in creation, we as a soul are dual, and that there actually is a soulmate for us. However, he was very quick to add, this has absolutely nothing to do with men, women, and romance. And even less does it have to do with any level of physical passion or sexuality, because by its very nature, it would have to transcend all of those physical identifications, or else we wouldn't be talking on the level of the soul. But Yogananda went even further to say that before you can be God realized, you must be reunited with your soulmate. And he said, if your soulmate happens to be on another planet, then that union can take place in vision. And that was the beginning, end, and middle of all he ever said on the subject. As Swami Kriyananda said, for obvious reasons, because otherwise everybody would have totally given up the search for God and would just spend all their time looking for their soulmate, since that's a prerequisite for God realization anyway. And hard as it is to keep people steady on the path, it would have been impossible. But nonetheless, he did say it. Swami Kriyananda has pretty much followed his guru's advice and recognized the sheer folly of wading into the subject. And so even though he has speculated on it quite a few times in private, he's rarely spoken about it in public, except to simply reiterate what I just reiterated. This is what Master said on the subject. Now, recently meaning a couple of years ago, when Swami Kriyananda was living in Los Angeles for a few months, and just one time I would go down there to visit him every couple of weeks, and we were in, I think he and I were the only ones there. I think perhaps Narayani was in the room, but almost no one else. But he just said to me, just because he was reflecting on it, he said, the desire in the human heart to be loved, He said, not merely impersonally by God, but personally by another individual, he said, is so deeply planted in our hearts that Swamiji said, I can't imagine that such a desire is not also meant to be fulfilled. Master said that every desire we have must be fulfilled before we are liberated from desires. When Master said that, Swami Kriyananda said, sir, even the desire for a chocolate ice cream cone? And Master said, yes, even that. That we have to be satisfied before we're able to transcend. So Swamiji said, in the light of that, how could this profound longing that we have not be fulfilled? In other words, he was, in his own way of thinking, working from Master's statement that we are made dual and that we have that longing. Now, most of the masters are not married and don't marry. Lahiri Mahashaya is a notable exception. He set the example of being a householder. Sri Yukteswar was married, in fact, but after his wife died, he became a Swami, a sannyasi. Yogananda, of course, never married. Jesus was not married. Babaji, it was unthinkable that any of them would marry. You do have Krishna in the past, who seemingly lived as a married man. So it's a little bit confusing. But nonetheless, in the state of self-realization that these masters represent, there's an important concept that I'll put in here right now. None of them were compelled to marry. They married because it was God's will that they live such a life, but they didn't marry as the ordinary human being marries, out of the desire for sexuality, companionship, family, home, whatever it might be. I myself, in my own life, I lived as in a formal state of renunciation for almost 10 years. I met my husband, I became a married person, then Swami created the Naya Swami Order, which allowed us to take the vows of sannyas, the same vows of sannyas that any orange-clad Swami would take, but without having to separate, without having to break the marriage bond. So my husband and I are Naya Swamis together. It's a new concept, Naya Swami. The vow is the same, but as Swamiji said, it's self-evident that our marriages have not prevented our dedication to God, so he saw no reason for us to force a separation in order to affirm that dedication. Now, where was the point I was going to say? Ah, yes. And my marriage to my husband has been really a wonderful experience. I believe it's helped both of us in our primary goal, which is to serve this work and to come closer to God. I don't believe personally I would have been able to do many of the things I have been able to do without the support that he's given to me. But when I imagine myself in another incarnation, and I find it easier to think that I will incarnate at least a few more times. It makes me too tense to think that this is the last one when there's no apparent sign that it is the last one. When it's the last one, you look like Swami Kriyananda. And if you don't, then we likely have a few more to go. But I didn't marry my husband. It wasn't entirely a free choice. I don't know how else to put it. There was an element of being compelled to marry him. Not compelled by God, but just compelled by my strong karmic inclination to want to be married to him. I'm perfectly happy to marry him 100 times more, but I would like it to be a free choice instead of a choice compelled by karma. You understand the difference? Now, when we think of the masters of Lahiri Mahashaya or even Sri Yukteswar, they had no karma. They had no unlearned divine lessons. So they were able to simply move where God wanted them to move, and their state of mind was equal in all circumstances. They were not restless for or against any particular lifestyle, just to make that single point clear. Now, from the point of view, though, so the reason I was saying that is because even though there is this idea of duality, and even though Swami talked about that deep desire to be loved by an individual, we really must separate this from either lifestyle or romance or sexuality. I said that once before, but I want to say it again, because these great masters live the example for us, And Master actually spoke of the fact that Babaji was his guru. He spoke of a previous incarnation in which he was Arjuna and Babaji was Krishna. But the relationship with Sri Yukteswar was also an exceedingly close relationship, and Sri Yukteswar was responsible for him in this lifetime. And there are hints, not clear hints, that perhaps the relationship with them, between them, was more of this that we're talking about, two halves of the same reality. And that's the union that brought them together again and again. That's something that Swamiji has merely just sort of thrown out as an interesting thought. The reason I say that is to break the thought in our mind that we must seek marriage, family, or anything like that in order to find that union. Our soulmate might be on another planet, and we can have the union be only in vision. Now, the reason I'm starting there, and then I want to go back to the Marie Corelli's book. Marie Corelli's story was about soulmates, but it was the most romantic, traditional idea of soulmates that you can imagine. She always wrote the heroine to be a lot like her. She was the talented, misunderstood, delicate female, moving way above the earth. And the hero that she meets, you know, is handsome and strong and all of these wonderful things together. And they finally find each other, and in a great misunderstood society, they become united, and then they sail off literally on his boat, and they just, for the rest of their lives, just cruise around together. Swamiji has remarked, any two people who would be satisfied just to be alone together for the rest of their lives must be exceptionally dull and stupid to just be able to be completely content with just one other person. But she had elements of truth in her story, and this is what Swami pulled out. When they meet, even in Marie Corelli's story, they first have to go through very serious testing about their own inner strength and their own capacity to hold to the truth and their own ability to see a higher reality in every situation before they're able to have that union with one another. And the way Swami has written the story, and this book will be published within a month here in India, the way Swamiji has written this story, it's really about the soul's desire first for God, and once that attunement with God is there, the divine prophecy of Jesus, seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added unto you. You see, this is why Master never talked about the subject. He taught, seek God. And if this is a divine reality, it will also come into your life. Now, we're talking on the highest level of God realization and something we literally can't imagine. But as above, so below. Meaning that what is true on the highest level is also true in this world. So this book that Swami has written it's a strangely romantic story without having the elements of romance that what we would normally think of. It's romantic in the sense that it actually satisfies an extremely deep and God-implanted desire for perfect love. But what it also talks about in a way that nothing has ever been written before, that talks about it, it talks about how that true love is finally attained. And in the plot, which is very, very creative, they have had many past lives together, and they have all these interesting elements about how every time some kind of selfishness, some kind of fear, some kind of egoic attachment, some kind of wrong understanding has just broken their connection time after time after time. And finally, in the course of lifetimes, it's not a detailed story, he apparently realizes that he's approaching this in completely the wrong way, and he goes deeply into sadhana and becomes more advanced than her. So when they finally meet again, he has now this enormous restraint, which had never characterized him before. And he recognizes that unless and until she also does the same kind of inner work that he has done, there's no chance of their union. And he's not going to allow himself to get drawn into the chaos that has been their relationship up until this time. So she then, profoundly motivated by the desire to be loved, you know, bravely takes on this very difficult sadhana, and it is no surprise she succeeds at it. And once she succeeds at that, both of them are standing in the same state of union with God. And once that union with God is there, harmony with each other is automatic. Now, this is a long and interesting story and a very absorbing read. I promise you, you'll love it. I had the opportunity to read it in manuscript form, and I was just glued to the book. I've told you that she succeeds, but it's not sure that she's going to. You just read it, you can't help. Because something about it just really speaks to the deepest part of ourselves, not just married people, not just romantic people, you know, monks, nuns, everyone. Because the desire for perfect love is the desire for God. And it's deeply implanted in us. It's just, this is an interesting story and a way to get there. Now, I mentioned to you that when I first came to Ananda Village, the lifestyle was monastic. And I was profoundly drawn to that lifestyle and really thought that would be my life for the rest of my life. Turned out I had an interlude before I came back to it. So I spent about 10 years with no expectation of ever having a relationship again. Perfectly happy not to. And in principle, I never changed my mind. In specific, I changed my mind because David showed up on the scene and that was pretty much, that was that. It was the end of my solitary life. But when people then ask me later, you know, I'm having difficulty getting along with my husband, I'm not able to attract a partner that I want, if my parents are arranging these marriages for me or a marriage for me, nothing is working out, I'm not getting along with my coworkers, I'm not getting along with my brothers and sisters, with my parents, with my children, whatever it is, I say, become a hermit, live as a renunciate for 10 years. That's the best training that I can think of. So far, nobody has taken me up on it, at least not with that intention in mind. Sometimes inadvertently it happens, but I hope not for all of you brahmacharis in this room. I pray that that's not the route that you have to take. But nonetheless, there's something, you know, there is, let me think how to put it. When Swamiji finished writing this book, I said to him, because I was there, I'm a very good first reader for Swami because I'm usually very enthusiastic about what he does and I understand the creative process. And so I was able to be the first, one of the first readers on this book. And in the course of my years of living the life that I've lived in the context of community where there's many families and many married people, for quite a few years, I did a great deal of marriage counseling. Just helping couples, new couples, old couples, just sort of work through what they're working through. And when Swami finished writing this, I said, Swamiji, this is what I have been wanting all these years, because most of the time when people come to me, I don't even know where to begin. Because everything that people think, especially about romantic relationships, but truly about almost all relationships, is just wrong. I mean, it's not even slightly misguided. It's just totally wacky. It's based on, in America especially, India is only recently becoming deeply corrupted, but I see you going down the same road really fast, where all these fictional romantic images are the images that people have in their mind of what real life is going to be. I actually had someone come once, told me that they were looking for a certain relationship, and then they described a certain movie that they thought described, showed them exactly the relationship they were looking at. I didn't know what to do. I took the woman's hand, I held it, I looked it deep into her eyes, and I said, that's fiction. Do you understand the concept? Fiction? That's made up. That's not real. It doesn't really happen. That doesn't exist. But we've lost, I don't think we ever had a profound understanding. Yesterday, a gentleman who was sitting there, I'm not sure you're still in the room, I don't see you here tonight, asked me the question about, he said that when he was growing up and in his life, there was a specific form of spiritual practice and religion, and he's finding that young people today don't have that form at all, and how are they ever going to find their way spiritually without all those forms gone? And then I talked to him about the fact that we're moving out of Kali Yuga, Kali Yuga is the material age in which things have fixed forms. We're moving into the age of Dwapara Yuga, in which energy is the defining reality. That's certainly what we see all around us. New forms of energy are the defining concept of the times in which we live. You know, everything is moved by more and more subtle forms of energy. We don't even understand them, we're just discovering them and using them. Well, one of the forms that's completely disintegrating is marriage and relationships, the roles of men and women, the way the family is structured. It's just all coming apart. I think it's coming apart faster in the West than in India, but it's still coming apart in this country to a large extent too. Women are being highly educated, trained for professions, and then have babies and are sometimes expected to stay home. And it's not a system that's really working all that well. Because we're moving into a time when people want to be guided, not by external forms, but by their own inner experience. And as a result, there's just no safe places for us to put ourselves, especially in regard to those relationships, but really in regard to the whole purpose of why we're drawn to each other and what we're intended to do. Now, until now, we've been able to impose upon ourselves the concept of family duty, duty to our society, all sorts of ideas that held people into these certain concepts. But even those we're watching all over the place are being disintegrated. People have begun to work for multinational corporations. These are the good jobs, and those jobs move you all around the country, and then those jobs move you all around the globe. And instead of living your whole life in these family, multi-generational family units, people are spread all over the world. The number of in the temple where we are in Palo Alto, which is in Silicon Valley, we have a phenomenon that I find very dear. Many very talented, ambitious young Indians have moved to Silicon Valley. And then they have children, and then their parents come to stay with them for 3 months or 6 months. And often they can't find anything for their parents to do, and then they discover our temple. And so many times a week, these Silicon Valley executives will deliver their traditional parents onto our temple grounds. And they're so delighted that they found something in America that they like to do. So we always see them in there, oh, so what company does your son or daughter work for? And how old is your grandchild? You know, because we know exactly what the picture is. But nonetheless, we're all having to think and live in new ways. And this is the difficult news, but this is the good news. And you know, these relationships, whether we're talking love relationships, parent-child, child-to-parent, brother-to-sister, friend-to-friend, everything now is not about being able to define the form and have everybody stay in the form. Even if we want to, we find we can't help ourselves. There's this compelling sort of individuality that is just pushing through the consciousness of the planet, which is what Dwapara Yuga is about. It's about the energy, the individual energy of things, the true individual experience, not the structure as it's always been. So we're having to really start over and understand on a much deeper level, why are we drawn to each other? Now, assuming that this whole idea, this ultimate idea of soul union as a necessary stage on the pathway to God realization is possible, assuming, as I will assume, that what Swami has written in this book that he has just published is a true account of what is required of us in order to meet that final test of relationships to one another, we begin to understand what the pathway is, even from the beginning. And the two songs that I was singing today, Go On Alone, Walk Like a Man, you know, follow your dream, even though others are not with you, no matter what other people say, be loyal to your principles. You know, this is the first prerequisite, oddly enough, for success in relationships. Not in a selfish way, not I will do what I want regardless of what you think, but what happens to us when we get in close proximity with others is that we become confused by their vibrations, by their demands, by their conflicting values with us, by the unpredictable responses that come out of us when people crowd our, what we call our freedom or our individuality, by the way we actually respond, sometimes in ways we didn't even know we were capable of responding. I remember when my mother was in the last years of her life and she had Parkinson's, and we fundamentally got along. In fact, we always had a positive relationship, but we didn't really have the same point of view about life. So I was dutiful to her and she was fond of me, but it wasn't an automatic intuitive closeness. And sometimes she annoyed me. And toward the end of her life, when she was somewhat weak, she just started down some particular track that had the capacity to make me impatient. And I felt this rising impatience in me, and I heard my voice getting more and more impatient with her. And all of a sudden I realized, you know, that I was about to start yelling at my ill 83-year-old mother. And I mean, I was just horrified, absolutely horrified. And I just closed my mouth and left the house in order to gain some mastery over my inner reality. But my, that was interesting to me. It was interesting to me that, you know, how out of control at times other people's energy can make us. Now, I have also been blessed in my life with one, I would call it a perfect relationship. And it's not been from me toward him, but it's been from him toward me. And that's been my relationship with Swami Kriyananda, which in my particular case, because I've known him for so many years and I've known him in circumstances long before he was world renowned, when we were really just a small group of people living together in this ashram, and access was very free and easy. Also, he kept at bay all the accoutrements of what his position in consciousness really justifiably should have asked of us, and just behaved in a very unassuming, friend-like way. So we were able to be very easy and relaxed with each other. You know, we didn't have to stand up when he came in the room. We didn't have to be silent. We didn't have to stand when he left the room. We were just friends together. And what I learned from him, from his example, is what a truly unselfish relationship looks like. And it's been the measure for me of every other relationship that I've observed or been part of ever since. Swami Kriyananda's relationship to us is very simple. He is interested in our well-being. And his only thought is what will help us. And the way he wants to help us is to help us to grow closer to God. But he's not averse to helping us with other things that we might be interested in along the way. So it's been a very relaxed and where are you trying to go and how can I help you get there? You know, and there has never been from him the conflicting force of needing something from us. Because his contentment in his relationship with God has always been so complete that he's been able to be, as I say, completely other-oriented when he relates to us. Now, many people have the thought of being like that, but it's not based first on an inner relationship with God. So it's the idea that, well, I'm not important. If that's what you want, that's what I'll do. I'll sacrifice myself for you. It doesn't matter what my interests are. It doesn't matter what my well-being is. And even though that looks like an unselfish attitude, the difficulty with that is that it lacks proper balance from an objective point of view. Because it isn't as if your children's welfare is really, in the divine scheme, more important than your welfare, or that the sacrifice of your appropriate well-being for someone else will actually bring about the result that you want. There's a principle of Ananda, which is, where there is dharma, there is victory. And the secret of right relationships that has taken me a long time to learn is this word that Swami used, which is called impersonal. And impersonal means that we simply look at things objectively without coloring them by our own preferences and desires. So that means, for example, that if somebody is making inappropriate demands of you, it's not more spiritual or selfless for you to go along with them. But an impersonal analysis of it says, that's really an inappropriate demand. And even though I might be perfectly capable of going along with it, it's not dharma for me to do so, because it's not righteous for me to do so. And sometimes when we're too personal in our relationships, we become inappropriate. And what I've seen with Swami Kriyananda is because his connection to the divine is so strong, he's able to just see what's going on around him, and the word that he responds with is he's always appropriate in his response to us. He's appropriate in being able to evaluate what will genuinely help people progress, and if it will genuinely help people progress, he's free in his heart to be able to do it. And if it won't, because the desire is inappropriate, he just can just as easily not go along with what you want. But it's always done from this impersonal point of view about what will take everyone in the situation to God. Let me pin this down to a more specific situation. There was a woman that I knew who was very selfless in her nature, but she was more selfless than she was able to sustain. And she was part of a working team within one of our communities, and they always had to make complicated schedules about who would cover what areas and when they would take time off and what they would do. And in her desire to be generous and helpful, she would always promise to do more than she was actually able to do. So when the time came when she was had to keep those promises, oftentimes she was ill or tired or just unable to carry it out. And the chaos caused by that was far greater than if she had just said at the meeting, this I can do, this I can't do. If instead of trying to be, you know, put forward the image of being selfless, she had just been impersonal about her strengths and her weaknesses, then everyone at the table could have simply seen, this is what the realities are. Those who have the strength to come forward will. Those who need to be supported will be supported, and we'll all together work this out. Now, this, in order to become clear enough to be able to actually know where you stand on these issues, this is the work that really makes it possible for us to have those kind of relationships. When I married my husband, I have a profound and everlasting aversion to housework. It is just simply that I cannot, as I put to him, I cannot ever imagine vacuuming a rug or cleaning a bathroom. Now, in India, you can hire people to do these things, which I think is a fabulous system. In America, it's a little bit harder to do, although we've managed to do it. But when we first got married, I said to him very simply, you know, I'm going to be a really interesting life partner for you, but I doubt if I will ever clean the house we live in. I will get an extra job to pay for somebody else to do it because I just can't bear to do it. And he was very nice about it, and he's very physically energetic, and we just had a little house, and he said, fine, I'll take care of it. So for many years, he really did. He just took care of the house, and that was just fine with me. I didn't mind a bit. And then at one point, he asked me extremely appropriately in just the right tone of voice at just the right moment if I could perhaps help by scrubbing out the bathtub every once in a while. I've had LASIK surgery on my eyes, so now I can see very clearly without glasses or contact lenses, but for many years of my life, I wore big glasses. So I actually had never actually seen the bathtub because whenever I was in it, I didn't have my glasses on. So the whole idea that it really needed to be washed out was like news to me, so I had to go in there with my glasses on and actually look at it. But he really wanted me to say yes to it, and I really wanted to say yes. But I also knew that I would never do it, just no matter what. And it had nothing to do with whether I loved him at all. And he fortunately never put it on those terms, nor did I. I just said, you know, I would love to, but I'm not going to. Because I can't. Now, I learned the hard way through some close relationships that I didn't know myself enough to know what I could actually honestly say. And this is one of the most difficult things that happens in relationships, is that we make promises that we do not have the money in the bank to pay. We don't have the karmic strength, we don't have the emotional clarity, we don't have the selflessness, we don't have the energy, whatever it is. And part of what I've seen in Swami Kriyananda that is so remarkable, and of course, he has an intuition that we all must strive to acquire, that he already has. He knows what to appropriately ask of you. And because he has nothing at stake, he doesn't need to ask more of us than we're able to give. In one particular situation, he asked of me something that he said strongly was really for my spiritual welfare, and I actually believed that it was. But it proved more than I could do. It was just as simple as that. And so I was in a very awkward position of him having asked me to follow a certain line of behavior, and I was, unbeknownst to him, not doing that. And I couldn't really live with that conflict, so I just had to say, "Sir, I believe that it was a good idea. I wanted to do what you asked me, but you need to know that I'm not doing it." He didn't hesitate for a split second. He said, "Well, so much for theory, let's work with reality. Okay, if this is who you actually are, then let's see how we can go forward from that spot." Now, how many of us in our close relationships, when somebody with complete sincerity says to you, "These are my limits," do we say, "No, no, you can do better than that"? And how often is that an actual desire for them, for their well-being? And how often is it just a desire for my own comfort? Because if you don't change, then I'm going to be unhappy. And it's a strange thing, because we're drawn together, you know, in whatever relationships they are, whether we're there by force, there by birth, or by work situations, or by choice, because we feel that something positive will come to us from this relationship. But as soon as we begin to imagine that people can or should fulfill the image that we have of what they're supposed to be. I remember once I was trying to put upon my husband some thought of some ideal for him, and I don't know how it happened, but Swami Kriyananda got in the middle of that. How that actual transition took place, I don't remember. But anyway, there it was, and I was sort of saying to him in this kind of, you know, nagging wife tone of voice, "Well, don't you think it would be a good idea if he did?" And Swamiji just looked at me and he said, "Yes." He gave that to me. He said, "Yes." He said, "But it has to be a priority for him too, and not just for you." And later, when I spoke to David about a different subject, I said to him, "You know, do you know what I'm asking of you?" He said, "Oh, yes." I said, "Do you think it would be a good idea?" He said, "Oh, yes." And I said, "Well, then basically, why don't you do what I say?" He said, "Because it's not my priority right now." He said, "Other things are more important to me at the moment." And it was just a very honest and true answer. Then I asked myself, where is all of this coming from? You know, in the name of what? It was the name of, "I would be happier if you were different." Is that love? That's just selfish ownership. And this is what people walk around imposing on each other all the time. "Now that you're my husband, you have to be this way. Because you're my son, you have to be this way. This is what I expect of my mother. Because you work for me, this is how you ought to behave." I mean, yes, many people have wrong consciousness. And many people will try to impose that wrong consciousness on us. And this is the balance between go on alone and many hands make a miracle. And the answer to this always is the word appropriate. You know, we must respond appropriately. Yesterday when I was talking, or the day before, I was talking about a situation with Swamiji in which I was cooking for him, and I insisted on making for him something he told me specifically he didn't want. And for reasons unknown to me, I tried to persuade him that he should do it my way, and I actually presented him, in this case, with a glass of juice that was not what he asked for. But he handled me so perfectly, I was forever grateful. He said not a word, not a single word, but he never touched the glass. He just never went near it. Okay, that's your opinion. But just because that's your opinion, that just simply doesn't mean that I have to be bound by your wrong thinking. Now, fortunately, the relationship we have is such that I paid attention and I trusted him. It's not always possible in our relationships to have things work out that clearly, but I absolutely promise you, where there is Dharma, there is victory. And if you think to win your relationship by wrong action, in the end you will lose both your own sense of dignity and the relationship. Nothing good ever comes that way. But often these are very hard choices that we have to make, because to buy the peace, to buy the short-term victory, to make it work properly, we'll do things that we really think that we shouldn't do. But somehow finding the balance between these two realities, recognizing that in unity there is strength, that fellowship in God is also the power, combining that with the courage to realize that I don't own anyone and no one owns me. I was interested once, a couple in our community separated, and when they separated, the woman said that the husband had always opposed her spiritual practice. And whenever she would meditate, he would turn on the television very loudly, and he would do everything possible to interrupt her meditation. They'd been married for 7 or 8 years. And very quietly, Swami Kriyananda just said, "I wouldn't have taken that for 15 minutes," is what he said. You know, there's just certain values that transcend all other values. And our first relationship and loyalty must be to God. And if we seek first the kingdom of God, then everything else follows after that. Because it's divine law, and because also once we're deeply content within ourselves, then we don't have to fight with the people around us. It just doesn't matter all that much what they do. That's where Swami Kriyananda can just let the chips fall where they may. He doesn't have to make people be anything at all, because he doesn't need anything from that. Now, we also really have to pay attention and we really have to listen. You know, we can't just be, this is again the balancing point here, because what also happens to us is the way people respond to us is very telling about who we are. I had a woman friend, I think her salient characteristic was how moody she was. I mean, from night to morning, you never knew what kind of a mood she'd be in. She got married, and after about 3 months of marriage, she came to me somewhat chagrined, and she said, "This may sound a little silly to you," she said, "but I never knew how moody I was." Until all of a sudden, she was with someone who was constantly feeding back to her, you know, what her reality actually was. So the kind of divine interactions that I'm talking about also have to be based on the same impersonal willingness to actually listen to the feedback that you're really getting. And if you consistently get the same feedback, you have to stop and ask yourself, you know, is this person objective enough to be telling me the truth? And if he is telling me the truth, do I really want to live the rest of my life with these as my characteristics? That's why we're put together. Sri Yukteswar, in his book, The Holy Science, talks about the purification of the heart. In the Bible, it says, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God." That's what Jesus says. And Sri Yukteswar talks about the same truth. The likes and dislikes of the heart are what bind us to the world of duality, because we're always saying, this is my pleasure, this is my pain, this is what I like, this is what I don't like, this is what I want, this is what I don't want. All of that emanates from the heart, whereas in fact, the truth of our nature is that everything is bliss, and the heart comes to rest in that understanding of God and no longer sees the opposites. It just sees the oneness of the spirit. That's our true, which is to say our pure nature. When we meditate, people talk about trying to calm the mind, but the restlessness of the mind actually emanates from the restlessness of the heart. It's very interesting. It's all the likes and dislikes of the heart that then cause the mind to be agitated. Reason follows feeling always. So Sri Yukteswar talks about the 5 stages of the purification of the heart. And the first three stages always involve our interaction with each other. And he talks about the fact how the heart compels us into close association with people, because its restlessness cannot be resolved unless we are faced with these, the tests to our equanimity that other people give us. So we also have to understand that even though we think what we should be allowed is these perfectly harmonious relationships, in fact, sometimes the only way we're going to learn is if the heart is deeply disturbed because of attachments or disappointments or whatever else it might be, and then that divinely implanted desire for perfect harmony in our love relationships just forces us again and again, you know, back into the battleground of maintaining an open heart, maintaining equanimity, maintaining the kindness that is absolutely essential. This is the underlying reason why people encourage you to marry for life. I mean, being now in a 30-year marriage, a little more than 30 years, I realize how long it takes to make a marriage and how often people quit at a point when there's really absolutely nothing wrong. And they either quit and actually separate, or they quit trying to work together because they just, and sometimes it's appropriate. Sometimes the combination just isn't going to take you anywhere. That's why Swami Kriyananda said, merely to stay together is not necessarily a spiritual victory. A spiritual victory is when, no matter what the challenge might be, one continues to expand one's capacity for perfect love. Whether or not that ends up having anything to do with the people in your life depends really on them more than on you. There's this story, and I think it's an autobiography of a yogi, of a man who had a very unpleasant, nagging wife. And he just smiled and said, "But I've gone where she can't find me anymore." And he'd just gone into the spirit. And so his consciousness was such that she could nag all she wanted. It no longer had any effect on him at all. And sometimes, ultimately, that's what we have to do. It's very interesting that Master's foremost disciple, Rajasi Janakananda, an American man. He was a self-made man. He was a millionaire. He was a success spiritually. He was a success in business. He married when his wife was like 18 or 19 years old. After 1 year of marriage, she had some kind of a serious illness. And after that, she was never mentally normal. So, and she wasn't able to have children, so there were no children to fulfill the marriage, and she was not mentally normal after that. And she very much opposed his spiritual life. And in many, many ways, she made his life very difficult. And all Master said was, "Oh, you were given that wife to teach you patience." Just like that. It was very interesting. And you know what's also interesting? Master Mahashaya, M., and the Blissful Mother in The Blissful Devotee, an autobiography of a yogi. I read in a book of biographies of Ramakrishna's disciples, his wife also was mentally unbalanced. Isn't that interesting? Two extremely great souls that were both close to Yogananda in his life, their destiny was to take care of a partner who was no partner to them because of their own inabilities. So we don't always know sort of where it's going and what it is that we're supposed to be learning. Sometimes what we're learning is the self-sufficiency to do the honorable thing regardless of what comes back to us. But to know what's appropriate in any particular situation requires the kind of spiritual depth of understanding that is our personal sadhana all the time. People often ask me, you know, what should I do? I said, it can't be answered in the general, because all of it has to do also, and I'll just give this last thought before I go to questions. When I draw the pictures of the chakras, which I will eventually before I leave the city, here's a vritti. And the vritti is held together, the whirlpool is held together by some thought in the center. And that thought in the center, whatever it might be, draws all this energy around it. sometimes we have a behavior that looks good, but the core that's creating the vritti, that's actually motivating the behavior, is not an honorable one. It could be fear of losing my position in society. It could be fear of creating conflict in the home. It could be fear of speaking up because of my absolute aversion to argument. You know, and it could be any number of things. So that whereas the behavior looks like the right behavior, the actual vritti is held together by something that needs to be dissolved. And there was a period in my life where I realized that I was nice because I was actually, it's hard to believe about me, but I was actually afraid to speak my mind truthfully. I just had this fear of speaking up. So as a consequence, I was so harmonious and I was so nice, but I wasn't really harmonious and nice. I was scared to death. And compulsion versus freedom, that's what we're really working with here. So what is appropriate in any specific situation depends on where you're standing and what's actually motivating you. That's why selfless service, self-sacrifice for one person may be a very appropriate forward-moving action, and for another it may be the exact opposite of what will actually lead them to spiritual growth. This is the exquisite, interesting, and ever-challenging reality of these relationships. And having watched Swami Kriyananda through the years understand people so exactly and treat people so individually is what's really made me realize, you know, how different this can be. There was a situation, this will be the last story before I ask questions. There was a situation in our community once, this was many, many years ago, when about five people, all in key leadership positions, became very confused with each other. And there was a lot of misunderstanding and a certain amount of ill will. And Swami gathered everyone together. And I was a peripheral participant. I wasn't actually one of those involved, but during those years, Swamiji would often have me in situations that I didn't really belong in because he was educating me about himself so that I could write about him. This I understood only later. He was showing me how he operated so that I would understand it. But with those five people, he went around and to each one he said something that was true. But to each one he said just as much as they were able to understand. And then, quite inaccurately, but with full knowledge that it was inaccurate, he put most of the blame on one person, who actually wasn't really the primarily at fault. But he was the individual who was, one, able to take it and would apparently benefit most from taking the blame. And the others he touched lightly. But they weren't going to hear it, so he just touched it lightly, and then he just let it all the weight fall on one person. Afterwards, I was talking to that man. I mean, we were enjoying it very much. Look, you know, I guess he has a lot of faith in you because he's letting you carry the whole weight of responsibility for this. And this is going to be the end of the story. Because it's not how we behave, it's what we're really trying to work out inside ourselves. So we have to be very respectful of these realities and not allow our intimacy with people to cause us to lose track. That's the other thing that really happens, as one of my friends said, if you live too long with people, you begin to think of them as extensions of your own mind, and you forget the degree of karmic and divine independence that they should have and the respect that they should have from you. So, questions or thoughts about this?
I was just wondering, you were talking about this intimacy, like in the intimacy relationship should not cloud your dharma. You should do your dharma and whatever action you do. But sometimes, can't it be like that, that dharma is very relative? What is dharma for me? Might be selfish for somebody else, almost. So,
yes.
I mean, how does that, you know?
The only way you can really know how to behave in relationships is if you spend a great deal of time, and I mean by this a great deal of time and energy, trying to come to an honest understanding of who you actually are. If you don't know yourself, you will be in chaos with the people around you all the time. And if you are in chaos with the people around you all the time, it's often a clue that you don't really understand your own motivations. And before you work too hard with other people, you need to really stand back and ask yourself. I mean, I don't know you personally, so I can't be speaking, you know, to you exactly, but I'll talk in principle. You know, what is my real reason for asking this? Is it really selfless, or does it just make me so uncomfortable when they behave this way? Am I embarrassed by their behavior? Do I feel their behavior threatens the welfare of the family? Do I think that it's dishonorable what they're doing and I want them to stop? Am I nervous when anybody moves outside of the boxes I've set for them? You know, where is the impulse to act and respond really coming from? Because people have an amazing instinct with each other, and they can tell when you're acting like it's for their welfare, but it's really about you. And if you're not completely centered and calm with faith in God and speak from that level of reality, you're always going to be a little off center, and people will sense that. That's why Swami Kriyananda, almost anything he says to anybody, they just recognize the immediate truth of it, because there's no shred of self-interest in it. But many times, especially in the early years of my marriage, what I said was for the welfare of my husband or the welfare of our family was just my own nervousness projected out, and I wanted him to make me feel less nervous by doing what I said. And I'm grateful to God and to him forever. He would have no part of it. You know, when he saw that I was just acting out of my own off-centeredness, he saw no reason to support that. He was not unkind about it, but he was also completely immovable. And then I would just find myself kind of panicked against nothing. Fortunately, we didn't fight. And when I found myself panicked against nothing, then it just kind of starts reflecting back. And I realize I begin to know myself. What is really important to me? Why am I really behaving this way? What am I really so nervous about? I began to realize, I'll tell you a personal story because it helps. My attachment is to ideas. I'm very Gemini, I do this as work. What I love is ideas. And whenever David would want to do something that I thought was the wrong idea, I would get very agitated. And I began to notice that it's like, if he didn't go along with what I thought was the best idea, I would actually panic. I would think that my life was at stake in some way. And the pitch of my voice would elevate and the speed would increase. And I began to hear that tone of voice. And that was the first clue to me, just to understand myself. Whenever I heard that tone of voice, whatever I was saying was wrong. No matter how persuaded inside my head that it was right, I knew it was wrong, because I could tell from all of that it was wrong. Actually, Swamiji says, very simply, the secret to harmonious relationships is courtesy. Whenever you're behaving in a rude manner, you're wrong. He also said, pay attention to the tone of your voice. And whenever you feel that tone shift into that anxiety, into that panic, you see, the other thing about it is, and this is so practical, it won't work. What you're trying to accomplish won't accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. Because people are going to defend themselves against what they know to be is really just your effort to impose on them your concept. My young nephew said to me, it was great, he said about my sister, his mother, who's a wonderful woman and a great mother, and I'm not going to absolve him entirely of responsibility with this statement, but he said, you know, my parents think that if such and so happens, it will be a problem, so they always don't want me to do that or this or that because they think something might happen. They don't understand that I have a lot of energy, I have a lot of creativity, and I think it's just a good adventure. And in fact, he was right. I remember my father trying to stop me from something I wanted to do when I was 18, because he predicted certain catastrophic results, all of which happened. He was absolutely right. But for him at his age, those were very serious problems. For me at my age, they were just the adventures of my life. And well-meaning, but misplaced. And because they were both dramatic examples, I've really watched it in peer relationships too. Is this really the truth of their reality, or is this my comfort that I'm trying to impose on them? And it's almost always in your tone of voice. Does that help at all? Tone of voice is, yeah. If you're saying it in that tone of voice, it's not going to work, and you're wrong. You're wrong inherently because your magnetism is off, and you're motivated by something that's off-center in you. Even if you're right on the facts, you don't have the magnetism to create what you want, so save your energy. Okay? Any other questions, thoughts? Yes.
It's like this, like the final quest is to seek God.
Yes.
And to seek Him, and yes. That's all. And nothing else, actually, we are really interested in the whole journey. So if that is so, don't you think that, you know, you are trying to put your ingredients, which are slightly in the lower level, okay, to adjust yourself in a comfort zone, okay, but you are wasting all your energy to use your intelligence, basically, to put yourself in a comfort zone with respect to all your relationship and sacrificing the higher goal altogether. Mm-hmm. So don't you think that you are wasting, you are using your intelligence to do all these things rather than you should be doing that? Right.
The question is the effort.
I'm not sure whether I could really express, but.
No, I think, let me see if this is what you've said. If you put too much energy and intelligence into trying to harmonize all your relationships, isn't that a waste of time when the only real relationship that matters is God? Well, that's why people become brahmacharis at a young age and never really get involved in the whole scene. And I think that's a really smart idea. I actually went that route myself and took an interlude into a marriage without children, partly because of just what you're saying. Even though I went to take a partner, I never saw the value of all the rest of the complexities, and neither did my husband, so we sort of compromised a little. If you genuinely can be a brahmachari and skip the whole thing, I think that's great. But you will find yourself with your fellow monks or nuns to work with. Okay, and this is where Sri Yukteswar's statement about the stages of purification of the heart really comes into play. Because we are compelled by the unresolved, by our unresolved capacities to be at peace in our own hearts, to rub up against other individuals. And the necessity to work those out, if we work them out in this way, if we work them out only, these are my psychological needs, these are yours, these are my social needs, these are yours, you know, this is our family arrangement. If it's all just done on the level of society and the ego, then it is a total waste of time. If, however, it's done with the thought that everything that comes to me is an expression of God's presence trying to teach me something that I need to know for the sake of drawing closer to Him. And when we look at it, we don't ask, what does He want? What does she want? What's the tradition of the family? We ask, what is the Dharma of this? And Dharma in this sense means, what is the action that will expand my consciousness and draw me closer to God? And sometimes that's long-suffering, patient self-sacrifice. And sometimes that's go on alone, that says, what you're asking of me is only your self-interest. It has nothing to do with my spiritual welfare. And respectfully but firmly, I refuse to cooperate. And which of those two realities is true is the art of it. And the only way you know is by becoming strongly inwardly connected through the power of meditation, through the power of sadhana, through the power of satsang, so that in that moment you can pray deeply to God, what do you want me to do in this? And it's very powerful, even in the midst of other people making demands of you, instead of responding with the first thing that comes out of your subconscious, just stand very quietly, put your attention at the point between the eyebrows and say, well, Divine Mother, what is it that you want to have happen here? And very often, when you just can stand centered in that way, very unusual answers will come to you. And often extremely effective, unexpected answers will come to you. Plus, in the midst of it, you will hold on to that direction. And then it is not a waste of time at all. It becomes a very powerful sadhana and a very powerful constant feedback to you. Otherwise, the danger of renunciation, which sounds really nifty, is that you just become very isolated and you learn nothing. You restrain all of these energies, but you don't purify them, you just restrain them. So family life, renunciation, it's just a coin toss depending on how you live it. But yes, you can encourage yourself to remember next incarnation that maybe you would rather just not do all this if that's who you are, but that's, you'll still be compelled by something to be involved with someone until the heart is free of the need for that, according to Sri Yukteswar. Does that make sense? Yeah, partially. It's not an easy question, but it's a good question. Yeah. All right. Anything else? We have time for one more. Yes, Shumakshi.
Ashaji, Swamiji has this relationship with Master, which, you know, which is now inward, and he feels Master within him all the time and guiding him, whether it's writing books or answering questions, all of that. And, you know, when we're in Swamiji's physical presence, a lot of times we feel bliss, we feel a sudden clarity, a lot of questions disappear. But, I mean, do you have any suggestions for how we can have a strongly developing internal relationship with Swamiji, so when he's not physically there or in the room or in the body, that, you know, you seem very tuned into him, and I was wondering if you have thoughts on that.
Well, his consciousness is not and never has been defined by the presence of his body or limited to where his body is, nor is being next to his body any guarantee of receiving the vibration of his consciousness. So one just has to start with the realization that these great souls are as present as we want them to be. Yogananda, Master said, to those who think me near, I will be near. So if it's important, if you're in love with someone, you don't have to try hard to think about them. I mean, when a mother or a parent has a new baby, their mind is always on the baby. Their mind never leaves the baby. You don't have to say, oh, remember you have a baby, you can't forget you have a baby. Now that's a spontaneous fact, but it's an indication of how attention follows desire. So if one has a desire to be close to anyone, especially a spiritual person, you surround yourself with elements of that consciousness. And as much as possible, you avoid those things which distract you from that consciousness. You know, people are always bringing me books, often bringing me books. Oh, this is such a great book. It's almost like Master's teachings. I think, if it's almost like Master's teachings, why would I want to read it? You know, when I can actually read Master's teachings. So I don't read other teachings. I just read Swami's books. I read Swami's books over and over. I listen to his voice. I listen to his music. We have, you know, it's not like this is obscure. We have an enormous wealth. And so it's not really that mysterious. Just as a kind of constant practice, just study and refer the situations of your life to the things he says and he does, and the things that Master does through him. And it's the way you solve problems. It's a little bit like the question I was saying to you, sir. It's like we take every situation of our life and use it for our real goal. And so if our real goal is God realization and we find ourselves in a family with lots of relationships, we try to use all those relationships to be an instrument of the divine and to receive the divine from them. And so they're not a distraction, because I'm always trying to be an instrument. If I'm always trying to be in tune with Swamiji's teachings, I try to solve every problem by trying to think, how would he handle this? I try to read his books and think about how they would apply to my life. I keep reminding things around me. And it just becomes perfectly natural. It's just the way you think, because you practice it that way instead of letting your mind get drawn in lots of other directions. Does that help? It's not really mysterious. It's just actual. Wherever you put your attention, that's where your consciousness develops. Yeah. Yes.
You talked about soulmates. Uh-huh. So is it just one soulmate, or do you have many soulmates?
Well, the word soulmate is a very inexact word in English. And so people use it, people toss it about in many ways. And many people talk about soul relationships, soul companions, soul mates, soul partners. And they're giving meanings to these words. I have no way of understanding this myself, so my whole discussion about soulmates was based on what Yogananda said and what Kriyananda said, because I have to take spiritual authority on this. I can't. Now, is it obvious that we have soul connections with many people? Well, self-evidently, some relationships are superficial, some relationships are materialistic, some are spiritually deep. So I think if we clarify our vocabulary, the conversation gets less confused. What Yogananda spoke of was a from manifestation, a duality to every individual, that every individual is a pair. On a level, as I said, that we can hardly even conceive of what that means. And before you merge into God, that pair comes together. But whether or not we're stumbling across that person in many incarnations, it seems possible and probable that we would. But yes, we're talking about a singular partnership. But the power of that must be so different than anything else that we experience. But I really just have to say, wow, isn't that interesting? In the Patanjali Yoga Sutras, he talks about three ways of knowing things: direct experience, inference from that experience, and spirit and valid spiritual authority. On this one, I'm going to go with valid spiritual authority. I don't trust my direct experience or my inference from that. But that we have connections on many different vibratory levels with people is self-evident. So however we vocabulary that would have to be the truth. That's why Yogananda never talked about this. And that's why I think it's amazing that Swami has waded into the water with this new book, you know, because it's a can of worms for sure. You know, that's very interesting. Well, all right, friends.
I'm sorry, I'm being rude.
That's all right. I'm about to close up the class anyway, so feel free to depart. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, we go forward with this same thing, unless I turn it into a class on the chakras. We'll see what happens tomorrow, okay? God bless you.